Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, March 25th, 2025, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps decision program on Delegati versus United States, which was decided last Friday by the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today quite brief. So if you'd like to know more, I highly recommend you check out his impressive full bio at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Matthew Cavanon, who's the Robert Poole Fellow in Law and Religion at Emory University School of Law. Before entering that role, he served for nearly 4 years as a public defender in Northeast Georgia, representing clients on misdemeanor, felony, and juvenile cases. And I'll leave it there. A last note throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions A, pertain to the program, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Cavanon, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Kayla, and thank you all for attending this morning. I'm going to give an introduction and then open the floor up to questions and answers. So Delegati v. United States is a case that grew out of a failed mob hit. Mr. Delegati was working as an enforcer for the Italian mafia in the greater New York City area and ordered a number of folks to commit a drive-by shooting of a victim who was suspected of being a local troublemaker. The people who went in the car and were armed did not themselves complete the hit, and so there was no killing. However, Mr. Delegati was then charged with a federal crime under 18 U.S.C. section 924C. That charge is for the use of a firearm during a crime of violence. The federal charge was predicated on New York attempted second-degree murder. So the federal charge required the government to prove that Mr. Delegati committed a crime of violence, specifically attempted second-degree murder. In New York, there are several different varieties of second-degree murder. Second-degree murder includes depraved heart murder, felony murder, or causing the death of a person with intent to cause the death of some person. Here's the rub. New York law allows second-degree murder to be based on acts of omission as well as acts of commission. Simply causing the death of another person could be through inaction. That usually comes up in the context of elder or child abuse, where somebody fails to provide enough food, drink, or medication to keep somebody alive. They can be guilty of New York second-degree murder, or by extension, New York attempted second-degree murder. The federal law, section 924, has as an element the use, the attempted use, or the threatened use of physical force. So to be guilty of the federal crime, you have to commit a crime of violence that has as an element the use, the attempted use, or the threatened use of physical force. Now, of course, nobody disagrees that Mr. Delegati's attempted crime in actual fact involved the use of force and involved a possible shooting. Just because shots were not fired doesn't mean he wasn't guilty of the attempt. However, the Supreme Court has said that Section 924 follows the categorical approach. What that means is when somebody is charged with violating Section 924 by committing a crime of violence, the courts look to whether the crime the person was charged with, the predicate crime, always, per se, involves the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force. Because there are some circumstances where a state law might cover some acts that do involve force and might sometimes not. That was the issue in the Delegati case, is whether or not New York attempted second-degree murder categorically involves the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force because it has that broader coverage involving any death of a person resulting from an act or omission intended to cause the death of the person. Hope you're all following that so far. I know there's a couple different moving pieces. The majority opinion was written by Justice Thomas. He was joined by six other justices. So this was a 7-2 decision. It also cut across ideological lines, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but the dissenter here was Justice Gorsuch, joined by Justice Jackson. The majority of the court held that knowing or intentional causation of injury or death to another person always involves the use of physical force, that it doesn't matter whether the defendant acts or omits to act. Anything that involves knowingly or intentionally causing the death of another person, per se, categorically, involves the use of physical force against another person. The majority held that it is impossible to deliberately cause physical harm to another human being without using physical force. What that means is Mr. Delegati is out of luck because he committed a violation of a crime that allows for an omission or an act that causes the death of another person. He therefore committed a crime of violence. In order to get there, the court had to break down what is physical force and what does it mean to use it. Physical force, the majority said, is anything that constitutes common law battery. It need not be violence per se. It doesn't have to be anything that goes beyond any sort of offensive or harmful touching. The court followed an earlier decision called Castleman in reaching that holding. In Castleman, somebody poisoned another person. They didn't touch the person. They didn't shoot them. They didn't hit them with a baseball bat or stab them with a knife. Instead, they left poison, and then the person drank the poison and died. And the question was whether that was a crime of violence. The Castleman decision held that it was. The Supreme Court therefore said that, hey, look, anything that constitutes common law battery involves physical force per se, even if it is not violent. In addition, the court said that any knowing or intentional application of force counts as a use of force. And here's the kicker for this case, the court said as a matter of plain English, the word use can include deliberate inaction. The court said that a mother who fails to intervene when her child drinks bleach uses that bleach to kill the child. Based on that, omitting to act when there's danger present is enough to constitute a use of physical force against another person. Lastly, the statute does say that that force has to be against another person. The court said that that's always satisfied whenever the defendant deliberately targets somebody. The court also looked a little bit to legal history and says that when Section 924 was enacted, 33 states defined murder to include omissions, and murder is a crime of violence if anything ever is. So based on that history and based on plain English, the court said that omitting an act that causes the death of another person is knowingly, intentionally, deliberately using physical force against that person. Justice Gorsuch says, hold on. If you have a lifeguard, world's worst lifeguard, let's even say a grossly negligent lifeguard, let's even say a malicious lifeguard, he sits back and twiddles his thumbs while somebody drowns in the swimming pool. Nobody would say that the lifeguard committed a crime of violence using physical force against the swimmer. This just does not line up with the way that we use English. Use is an active word. Sorry, use, not use. Using physical force. That's an active phrase. It's not a passive one. That means that you go out and do something. You don't just omit to do something. The lifeguard doesn't use physical force by sitting back and letting somebody drown. Likewise, Justice Gorsuch, and again, joined by Justice Jackson, but it's Justice Gorsuch's opinion, he says that a violent physical act, it's not just common law battery. Congress knew the term common law battery if it wanted to use it. A violent physical act has to be something more than just any offensive or harmful touching. It has to be some sort of forceful. physical contact with another person. Now, it doesn't have to be direct. Just as Gorsuch looks at Castleman involving poisoning and says, look, that's an indirect physical act, but it is still a physical act. You're still poisoning somebody. That's like using any other weapon against them. If you hit somebody with a baseball bat, if you stab them with a knife, you're still using physical force against them. And poison is analogous to that. However, that's different from omitting an action. As far as this common law history and 33 states defining murder to include omissions, Justice Gorsuch says, why are we even looking at this? The federal statute defines, Section 924C defines a crime of violence as any crime that has as an element the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force. We don't need to worry about how many states define murder to include omissions or what battery counted at common law as. The federal statute tells us what a crime of violence means for these purposes. That's enough. In addition, Justice Gorsuch says, the common law still defined any of these omissions as being criminal only when somebody had a duty. It is not that any omission or even any act that causes harm counts as common law battery. Especially under the omissions side of things, you have to have a duty to act before you can be found guilty of a common law battery. Even if we're going to imagine that a lifeguard sitting back and letting somebody drown is a battery, they're actually only liable because they're a lifeguard. We don't extend that globally to anybody who fails to act. Justice Gorsuch says that this is kicking the door open to all kinds of liability beyond what Congress imagined and beyond what the common law imagined. So we get all of the expanse of the common law with none of the limitations. This makes no sense. So to sit back and look at the opinions here, the majority has decided that as a matter of law, silence can sometimes be violence. And inaction can be the use of physical force. That letting somebody die can be physical use of force against that person and can therefore be a crime of violence for purposes of Section 924C. My inclination here is to say that this is a bad case that makes bad law. That, look, Mr. Delegati, of course, is as much of a violent criminal as anybody's going to be. That a mob enforcer who orders a hit job to be done on somebody, orders that a drive-by shooting happen, that is very much a crime of violence, and that the court has very little patience with saying that it's not. But that expanding liability for crimes of violence here to include omissions, which is what the majority's opinion ends up doing, is difficult to justify based on precedent, based on logic, and based on the plain rules of English. I find the dissent much more convincing here. As far as a broader context goes, this case is yet another one where the categorical approach is annoying judges. The court has said that when we look at Section 924C, like a number of other federal crimes, we use the categorical approach. We only look at the elements of possible predicate offenses. We don't look at the facts. We rarely look at indictments and charging documents. We stay away from particular circumstances. And that leads to results that courts often don't like. What I think is going on here is a fair amount of the court, at least on these facts, do believe that Mr. Delegati is a violent criminal, do believe that he should be liable under Section 924C. But the categorical approach is forcing them to meet that intuition in a very roundabout way by over expanding the definition of what counts as a crime of violence. The categorical approach oftentimes operates to limit criminal liability by saying that if some versions of a crime don't involve violence, then they cannot serve as predicates. But if we just water down the definition of violence and force and use of force enough, then we wind up with a near limitless reach for this federal criminal statute anyways. So common sense-wise, the outcome makes perfect sense. Morally, it makes perfect sense. As a matter of law and analytical reasoning, I think it gets it wrong and winds up, yeah, again, trading a much loosier-goosier definition of crime of violence for the fact that the categorical approach lives to die another day. So there we go. I am eager to have conversation and hear more about your thoughts on the case.
Well, thank you so much for that summary of the case, as well as the decision and the dissent. It was really, really helpful. I'll issue a reminder to our audience, if you have questions, you can submit those via the Q&A feature. And we already have a couple, so we'll go ahead with those. What an attendee asks, what significance do you accord to the distinction between the liability of negligent lifeguards and parents who have a duty and this mafia man, Ari the Holding?
So at common law, omissions can only count as batteries and can only act as crimes of violence if somebody owed a duty. Here, a mafia man does not owe a duty to his intended victims, at least until they're injured. If you create somebody's risk, then you might be liable for other things. But setting that aside, yeah, our mafia man here doesn't have any kind of an arguable legal duty. So this is a case where the court is relying on the common law in order to define what counts as a battery, what counts as the use of force, but is not accepting the limitations on that. As far as what the significance of that is going to be moving forward, I think it's pretty clear from Delegati, there's not going to be any kind of duty element in order to commit a crime of violence. Anybody who does the act that would count as a common law battery now can satisfy 924C, even if they don't owe a duty. How exactly we're going to set the outer limits on that is not clear. The paradigm examples of an omission under New York's statute giving rise to liability for second-degree murder would be somebody failing to provide proper care for an older person or for a child. Most of the people who would get charged with that are people who owe duties to the vulnerable person. It would be a caregiver, it would be a medical professional, it would be a parent, or something like that. Are we going to see the federal government charge somebody who has some looser relationship with a vulnerable person who dies under 924C? I don't know. Are you going to see some enterprising prosecutor charge, say, a roommate of an older person with 924C because they committed an omission, and so this could be second-degree murder under New York's definition? I don't know. Now, the New York courts may well apply limitations there, and that might be the kicker, is if New York says that you have to have some kind of a duty before you're guilty there. But again, Mr. Delegati, in fact, committed a crime that was active, so maybe that's the way out. But the ball may be back in the New York court's corner to say that, look, you have to have a duty before second degree murder can attach to an omission. And I'm not an expert on New York law. I am all but certain that they have said that. But this might be another place too, where New York's definitions or maybe different states' definitions of when you owe a duty might affect the scope of liability under 924C as well. These are odd problems that come up when you have a federal law that incorporates as predicates laws of 51 or 53 different state and territorial jurisdictions. Is there's just weird interplay. And so what might get you liable under 924C in one jurisdiction may not in another, and so on and so forth. It's a mess. And it's a recurring headache whenever we have these kind of categorical predicate crimes.
Got it. You mentioned this didn't split along ideological lines. It's a really interesting sort of 7-2 as it shook out. Couple questions on that. First, were you surprised to see the way it shook out? What does that interplay mean for the theories of statutory and constitutional interpretation we're seeing play out? Looked a little bit like it was an originalist versus textualist. Maybe correct me if I'm wrong on that. Sort of read of the statute, the sort of interplay between the two opinions.
That's an interesting question. And there's a lot of different directions that it can branch out into. First, I wouldn't say it's an originalist versus a textualist approach. I would say it's a textualist versus a contextualist approach. The majority is looking at legal context here. The majority says they're not resting their hat on the fact that 33 states define murder to include omission, but they mention it. So obviously it's a part of what is going into the mix here. That's not necessarily in tension with originalism. They're saying that when Congress uses a term like crime of violence, they have in mind, whatever definitions of murder are floating around out there, that's still looking at the meaning of the language at the time it was enacted. But Justice Gorsuch, joined by Justice Jackson, are definitely doing a narrower inquiry and saying, look, we can just read this statute. We don't need to look at any state precedent. We don't need to look at common law background. This is an idiosyncratic federal statute. It's got its own definition provided right there. That's all you need. You don't need that legal context. The text needs to take priority. We have seen a couple of times now clashes between Justice Thomas and Justice Barrett on the role of tradition, and sometimes some of that background in interpreting the meaning of the original meaning of language. That's not how this case shook out, in that Justice Barrett joined the majority opinion by Justice Thomas here. I think the reason for that is because this whole 33 state thing didn't make a huge difference. It was one out of several different arguments that the majority deployed, and the majority said that they weren't relying on it, I think, in order to avoid committing to any particular holding concerning what the methodological significance of that background is. It will be back. There will be other places where that clash comes up. But at least for purposes of Delegati, the court was saying, look, if you find this persuasive, here's one more reason to agree with us. If you don't worry, we've got other reasons that are going on here. It makes me wonder if Justice Thomas either received that from somebody else who thought it was more significant, or whether he included it in order to win over a couple more folks. As far as the ideological division in general goes, Justice Kagan has shown a lot of interest in a straightforward textual reading of federal criminal provisions. Y'all may remember the red fish, blue fish, one fish, two fish case, the Yates case back years ago. Justice Sotomayor has shown a real interest oftentimes in ruling for criminal defendants. She didn't hear. That said, she's also from New York and probably has a much more in-depth knowledge of New York law than most of the other justices do. So I don't know if her personal experience and knowledge and her experience as a federal judge in New York particularly swayed her a little bit on this. As far as Justice Gorsuch and Justice Jackson being dissenters here, it's not a huge surprise that those two could find themselves in a dissent on a federal criminal case. Both of them have shown a lot of interest in pro-defense textualist readings of things. Justice Jackson herself, a former federal defender, so not a huge surprise there. Chief Justice Roberts has often shown openness to that when he's convinced that the straightforward reading of the text favors the little guy or favors a criminal defendant. So maybe a little bit surprised not to see him in the majority on that. One thing that I will be curious to see going forward is this is a pretty tightly textualist opinion. That definitely reads like a Justice Gorsuch opinion. I'll be curious to see whether Justice Jackson is as interested in tight textual-only readings without context, without policy considerations in the future, or whether that's more in the context of a ruling that, or an opinion that favored a criminal defendant. So not sure exactly what to do with that going forward. Justice Gorsuch, he's been called the new Scalia for a lot of reasons, but one of them is that he's absolutely willing to follow what he thinks is the best reading of the straightforward text if it benefits a criminal defendant. So not surprised there.
Good. Thanks so much. Next question, and this you touched on this a little bit in sort of your closing comments, asks whether you think the moral reprehensibility of the facts in this case affected or colored the thinking of the majority of this decision. And I'll add to that, because I'm curious, how did we end up at a categorical approach here? And this isn't being considered on the facts, it's being considered as a categorical issue.
Yeah, so Section 924 penalizes using a firearm during a crime of violence. Now, granted, there has to be some sort of connection between the firearm and the crime that gets committed. So maybe that is a good argument for, look, how on earth can a lifeguard who's just sitting back twiddling their thumbs be using a firearm in omitting to rescue a drowning swimmer? They would never get charged with 924C. But how much are the facts driving this here? if you had somebody who was more innocuously using the firearm, and I'm trying to think of a good example of that, the Supreme Court has held that using a firearm as an exchange medium in a drug deal, trading somebody a gun for drugs, that can be using a firearm during the course of a drug crime. It's not using it for threatening. It's not using it for force. But then again, that also wouldn't violate 924C, because dealing in drugs is not a crime of violence. It doesn't have an element using force. I guess I'm still trying to play with, number one, that question from before about how much does this lifeguard issue matter? But then also, number two, how much are the facts here driving this?
No, I literally...
By the time that using the firearm is somehow furthering a crime that has as an element the use of physical force, I'm finding it a little bit more difficult than I expected to come up with a fact pattern where the use of the gun is innocuous. If you have somebody who's the roommate or caregiver for an elderly person and they kill them by neglect, they're probably not using the firearm to further that. If they are threatening that, look, I will shoot you if you try to leave the room or get food, I'm inclined to think that the moral heft there actually probably is still with the prosecution. And I think that the law actually does favor the prosecution in that case. I think there you actually are threatening the use of violence. I think the long and short of it is I may be talking myself out of this being a super big practical problem as we get further into this. I am not as convinced as I was probably 5 minutes ago that the facts of this case really changed the outcome in practical terms. As a law school problem in the abstract, yes. The fact that we now have this category of omission that is treated as the use of physical force still does seem crazy to me. And I still think the dissent has a better reading of this. That said, and if anybody's coming up with a better factual scenario, please do put it in the questions and answers box, because I'd like to wrestle with it more. I'd like to be convinced that I was right the first time. But I am not as sure now that I am thinking about 924C as a whole more. I am not as sure that the hideous facts of this case are driving the opinion as much as I thought, mm-hmm. or the majority opinion as much as I thought that it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, next question. In a conflict of laws analysis, with the understanding that there is no federal common law a la Erie, how do you think this will be applied in New York cases under New York law with no federal constitutional issues, since it's a Supreme Court decision affecting common law?
So I don't know New York conflict of laws analysis at all. For New York state courts, they are welcome to do whatever the heck they want if they simply choose to say second degree murder includes no omissions at all. Well, then they effectively reverse Delegati as applied within the state of New York. The state courts are in the driver's seat as far as defining that second degree murder statute. They can do whatever they want. They can impose additional elements. I mean, not necessarily with legitimacy and authorization. They shouldn't do it for nakedly policy reasons. But as a matter of jurisdiction and authority, I mean, the New York courts are the final say. If the New York courts wake up tomorrow and issue a holding that second degree murder means and only means screaming the word Roger while killing somebody, I mean, then their 924C's predicate offense has gotten totally redefined and the feds would just have to follow that. Erie analysis, the Supreme Court took the first bite at the apple here in defining how second degree, I don't know about the first bite at the apple. The U.S. Supreme Court has taken a bite at the apple in telling federal prosecutors and telling New Yorkers what the New York statute means. As far as what the New York Court of Appeals does tomorrow to change the course of that, I mean, their hands are not bound by anything the U.S. Supreme Court has said about what the meaning of New York law is. They can do whatever they please on that. New York attorneys who are concerned about this, maybe folks who are practicing in both state and federal court, should look for an opportunity on a state case to push back against the stretch of what's been achieved here with Delegati by looking at the omissions requirement or the duty requirement or something along those lines, or by attacking some other element of the second degree murder statute. I hope that answers the question. I'm not sure I totally did, but I think that that's what the question was asking, and I think I just answered it.
Sounds good.
It's not posted yet.
Perfect. We did have someone put forward a factual. So let's assume a firearm was used to prop open a door to enable a criminal to enter the building for a crime.
Fair enough. Yes, given that the Supreme Court has said that trading a firearm, and granted, would a defense attorney reasonably argue that at least using the gun in a drug deal is because a gun is valuable because it's a dangerous implement, whereas using it as the equivalent of shoving a phone book in the door is just a sheer accident. I mean, you could use a gun, you could use a brick, you could use a phone book, you could use whatever, you could use your foot, you could use whatever you had handy. I mean, as a defense attorney, I would argue that, but you're right. I mean, that would be furthering the crime, but that wouldn't be a crime of omission. I mean, if you use the gun to jam the door so the DoorDash driver who the child called to prevent their starvation. I mean, I'm a law professor. I like hypotheticals, and even I'm thinking that we're getting a little bit down the road here as far as anything happens. If we get a prosecution based on it, email me and maybe we'll send that back to the Supreme Court. But excellent job rising to the challenge that I set out. You're right. That is a hypothetical where you used it to further a crime of violence. Now, if you can come up with a real world example of somebody using a firearm to further an omission act of violence that kills somebody, but not using the firearm in a way that's related to the violence. Well, again, email me if you see a news story dealing with it.
Well, we have a sense of what this means for Mr. Delegati. This charge, I think, can't stand anymore. What are the broader ramifications of this case, both as other defendants are being tried and in spaces beyond this for other crimes of omission?
Well, first, for Mr. Delegati, this charge does stand. So he was challenging this charge, and the court says, look, the New York second-degree murder statute.
I'm so sorry, yes.
So Mr. Delegati's out of luck. I mean, he has lost this leg of his appeal. I don't know what other charges he may have been facing, or I don't know a lot about the procedural posture of this case. So, but regardless, he can now be validly convicted under 924C based on that predicate. As far as other cases go, I've been wrestling a lot during the course of this question and answer session with how many real world cases is this going to affect? And the answer is, I'm not sure. A ruling the other way, saying that, look, New York's second degree murder statute is not categorically a crime of violence, absolutely would have meant that a number of defendants would have a good defense. It would have meant that defendants who were charged with felony murder or with depraved heart murder, those could not be predicates for 924C. So it would have limited the scope of the federal statute to more state categories of murder that involves some sort of intent to commit serious harm against another person or to kill another person or something along those lines. Kayla, I want to come back to your question from earlier, though, because I forgot to answer it, which is, how did we wind up with the categorical approach, and where do we go from here with this? The categorical approach in the federal firearm statutes concerning possessing a firearm during a crime of violence, which is what's charged here, or possessing a firearm as a convicted felon, which is 924G, as well as in a number of immigration-related criminal statutes. The federal statute will look at somebody's criminal history or at criminal acts that they committed. In order to cover the huge variety of laws in the United States, because we have so many different states, because we have DC, because we have territories, a lot of federal statutes are written in such a way that they cover a potentially large amount of predicate offenses. They'll say something like, anybody who's ever committed a crime of violence. That's in fact the language that we've been arguing about here. How do you figure out what is a crime of violence? There are a couple of possibilities. One is to look at the facts, to look at each individual case as it comes and say, look, did you use violence in furthering this criminal activity? That is not the approach that the U.S. Supreme Court has taken to these kinds of categorical crimes. Rather, what the court has said is we are going to take the categorical approach. When Congress uses the phrase crime of violence, the Supreme Court has said we put a lot of emphasis on that crime part. Not is this individual criminal activity violent, but is this a crime of violence per se? So what we are looking at is the elements of the crime as spelled out by the state and saying, look, is this an inherently violent crime? Sometimes we look a little bit at the indictment or other charging documents, if there's a couple different ways to commit a crime. But generally what we're doing is we're trying to say, if you have a crime called reckless conduct, is that inherently violent within the state that we're talking about? Sometimes the answer is yes, sometimes it is no. Sometimes you have a crime where the elements cover both violent activity and nonviolent activity. Reckless conduct or disorderly conduct might be good examples of that. It could be that you're flailing your arms about and saying things in public. It could be that you are shooting a gun into the air and seeing what happens. Both of those could be reckless conduct under certain circumstances. Both of those could be disorderly conduct under certain circumstances. The categorical approach says that we're going to look at the definition of the crime. If it covers both violent and nonviolent conduct sometimes, then it is not a crime of violence. Now, that approach has been criticized a ton because it leads to crazy results. Like somebody who's trying to kill somebody having a good argument that, look, I didn't commit a crime of violence because somebody else might have committed it nonviolent. On the facts, it is oftentimes highly unpopular as a result and sometimes gets judges saying things like, why are we even debating that smashing somebody repeatedly over the head with a baseball bat is a crime of violence? Of course it is. Nevertheless, that's what the categorical approach does. Now, the defenders of the categorical approach say, look, we do not need to sit down with each individual case and try to build a whole common law from scratch of what is violent based on what facts, based on all these things. That's a mess. And that's not what Congress intended. Congress didn't mean each individual act gets assessed on its own four corners. So folks who are interested in this, there's a lot of U.S. Supreme Court precedent. Every year you'll get one or two cases wrestling with this. Delegati avoided it, and I was curious to see whether or not they were going to take another swing at it, pun intended. They chose not to. But this is something that's going to come up again, I guarantee it, whether it's a 924 firearm charge, whether it's an immigration case, something, there will be more dispute among the justices. Part of the reason why I think they didn't bother this time is they've been at a logjam. This has been argued about for years now, and there still has not been a majority to throw out the categorical approach. It just goes around and around and around. Delegati here, they were able to get 7 votes for one approach. That is what it is. Now, again, my critique of that would be, I think they did it by selling out a way too loose definition of what is a crime of violence. But them's the breaks.
Thank you. Question less because it pertained to the actual way the decision came out and more because it was discussed pretty extensively, if I remember correctly, in oral argument. There's two, if I remember correctly, clauses in the statute in question. There's the elements clause and then there's residual clause. Residual clause has been thrown out as non-constitutional, but still was discussed a fair amount and even mentioned in the majority opinion. Can you give a little bit on what that is, why it could have been relevant, and how it was considered as potentially relevant by Mr. Delegati?
Yeah, so Section 924 at the very end of it, like a lot of these categorical approach crimes, will just have a catch-all clause at the end and say, well, and any other crime involving violence or any other crime involving the use of force or whatever it is. Now, Kayla, you made a great point, which is a few years ago, the Supreme Court said this is unconstitutional. That was a Justice Scalia opinion. What he based it on was due process and the right to have notice. Generally, you need to have notice of what activity a criminal statute prohibits before you can be found guilty of it. The Supreme Court said a few years ago that whenever you say any other crime that involves something, that's just way too loosey-goosey. Your average person out there in the world does not know which of the bagillions of statutes out there might trigger that, what of the bagillions of things that they might do might land them an additional 5 years in federal prison for violating it. that was a contested decision. There are a number of justices, including several on the court still, who disagreed with that and said, look, the residual clause is as good as anything, and it opens the door to us doing more factual inquiry, to taking a harder look at the facts of cases. It is Congress's way of solving this problem, and it was kind of an easy out for the courts to say, well, it just violates due process, so we're not going to do that anymore. Certainly, prosecutors want it back. And there are a number of justices who've made it clear that they think the categorical approach is wrong. One way to get around the categorical approach would be to say, well, that applies to subparts A through H, but subpart I means that we can still do a bunch of factual analysis and catch these kind of fact-specific crimes. Court chose not to do that this time around, but the fact that, again, it comes up every year, year in, year out, and still has not shifted the law, I mean, this is something that's going to continue to be litigated. Another possibility, and I don't mean this as a joke, but Congress could also try to do something about it. I know that the odds of Congress doing what the court can't are slim, but Congress could fix a lot of this by simply taking another look at the statute. Congress could spell out, and granted, it would be painstaking, it would require a lot of updates, but Congress could spell out all the individual state statutes that can serve as predicates. Or Congress could just rewrite crime of violence and say, look, we agree with the dissenters over and over again. Categorical approach is goofy. Just tell courts to look at the individual facts of cases and not do this sort of weird, we're going to look at what states have and whether it can cover nonviolent conduct. I mean, Congress could change all of this. If Congress can do anything and can agree on something, then they could give that a shot. But there you go.
Well, that leads into the last question I have, and barring any from our audience, we may wrap early and give people a section of their days back. Now that we have this decision, what are the questions that remain unanswered, if any?
The Supreme Court did not really take this case because it felt like it was absolutely urgent to say something about New York's omissions part clause of the second degree murder statute. Like, that's not by itself a big deal. The big things are categorical approach. And I'm thinking here that the court just wasn't satisfied. Sorry about that. But the court just wasn't satisfied that it could come up with a majority for a better approach at this point. So that does still remain a live issue. Part of it is, yeah, I think a little bit. I think that's actually where the moral outrage at the facts did probably come in. You've got a mob enforcer who is arguing that, look, I shouldn't be liable for ordering a hit on somebody because somebody else could have committed this through omission. I think that is part of what caught the eyes of the judges. There's not a whole lot more work to be done there. Now you have at least foreclosed that space of arguments from defendants of, you know, look, some omission prong of a murder statute is going to mean that there's no 924 predicate. There's not a whole lot of questions left on that specific ground. Otherwise, I mean, I do think categorical approach and what exactly it means and what's in and what's out, that's going to continue to get litigated. I mean, 924 has that all over the place. All these immigration statutes do. Certainly with the new administration's desire to push a lot of immigration enforcement very hard, I think you're going to see them arguing that a lot more prior convictions count as deportable crimes. And so you're going to wind up right back here with arguing about categorically, is this a crime or not? Now, what I will be curious to see, though, is this a one-off watering down the crime of violence thing to include omissions that also involve the use of firearms for force? Or is this part of a broader trend of, all right, look, if we can't do the categorical approach, we'll just water down to other elements and make it easier to satisfy them with predicate offenses and sweep in more and more and more predicate crimes as a way of getting around that. The pushback to that would be, although we are struggling to think of jamming guns in doors and using that to further whatever, there are other cases that will be more borderline. This absolutely does send a signal to prosecutors of go ahead and try and charge it and see if you can argue that it's a crime of violence. So we'll see whether or not the court winds up continuing to water down what counts as that as the trade-off for not being able to make progress on the categorical approach.
Got it. Well, with that, we can wrap. Thank you so much for taking the section of your morning and sharing your expertise and insight and sort of breaking down this case and where we may be headed. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.